Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the latest exchange of fighting between Hezbollah and Israel. Does it bring us closer to a regional war? And will ceasefire negotiations for the Gaza conflict, the root of it all, ever come to an agreement? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Gideon Long, and on this edition, we hear how businesses in India are trying to make the most of the country's ageing population. And we take you to the Philippines and a slightly unusual reason for a delay to a big infrastructure project. And we're in Switzerland, where they're looking for new ways to make chocolate.
I think you could compare it to maple syrup.
Yeah. This you could put on your toast.
Yeah.
This is very sweet.
That's all to come, but let's start in China, because the US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan is in Beijing for 3 days of talks. The two sides are due to discuss a range of issues, from Taiwan, which China claims as its own, to trade relations, which have been difficult for some time. Sullivan touched down a day after Canada became the latest Western nation to impose fresh tariffs on imports from China, in line with those already announced by the US. The Canadians announced a 100% tax on Chinese-made electric vehicles and a 25% duty on Chinese steel and aluminium. The Chinese Foreign Ministry responded at just about the time that Jake Sullivan was stepping off his plane in Beijing.
Canada's action ignored the objective facts, disregarded WTO rules, and went against the trend of history, which is a typical act of protectionism. It doesn't only undermine China-Canada trade and economic relations, but it also hurts the interests of Canadian companies and consumers. China strongly deplores and opposes this.
Well, I've been speaking to Han Lin, the China country director at the Asia Group based in Shanghai.
So this is actually a very good sign. It speaks to the continued momentum from when Biden and Xi Jinping met each other last year in November. I guess to give you some context, at one point, U.S. and China had about almost 100 different types of dialogues going on across trade, geopolitics. And then at one point, it fell down to below three. And now we're comfortably at around 20 or so. And so with Jake coming through to represent the U.S., I think there's a lot to talk about, not only geopolitics, but even the mundane issues of trade and economics as well.
And on those trade and economics talks, what do you think they will be discussing specifically?
When we talk about economics and trade, I think the clear thing that you hear from the China media is their demand that the U.S. stop turning economic and trade issues into political and security-related issues. And so that's really the beef that China's been having. And in particular, what they point out to is every time China wants to export its electric vehicles or EVs, it gets a response by its trading nations through tariffs. And we saw that most recently with Canada.
That's right. We've seen these announcements over and over again from the US, from the EU, of tariffs against everything from Chinese EVs to steel to aluminium. The latest announcement, as you say, coming from Canada. So how do these announcements, how are they received in Beijing? How do they go down there?
According to China media and how the China responds, they essentially believe that the US or other Western allies are in a campaign to suppress China in some way or form. And they often argue that they have been quite consistent in their policy to the U.S., which is anchored by mutual respect peaceful coexistence and a win-win cooperation.
And China has retaliated, hasn't it? So, for example, when the West stopped exporting equipment that the Chinese want for chip manufacturing, China responded and it said it would stop the export of rare earth metals like gallium and germanium that the West wants to get its hands on for its own tech industry. So just last week, the Chinese said they were announcing an investigation into EU dairy products, for example, to see if they'd been unfairly subsidized. So it doesn't feel as though there's any end in sight to this kind of tit-for-tat battle.
And you bring up a good point. When China thinks about what the appropriate strategy is, what they would like to do is to be able to carve out the alliances, to separate themselves so that, for example, the US and Europe are not seen eye to eye, or there are differences of opinion within the EU itself. So for China, that seems to be the plausible approach in terms of their strategy. But one thing you have seen is this, is that at least from looking at it within Shanghai, there is a tit for tat, but there is an attempt to restrain it so that there is an appropriate response, not an over-escalatory response.
And finally, Professor, you started this interview by saying that it's good news that Jake Sullivan is in Beijing, and we're talking about the difficulties of the Chinese relationship with the West. But actually, it's probably better than it was a couple of years ago when I think back to that Nancy Pelosi trip to Taiwan, or in 2022, or the US shooting down the Chinese spy balloon in 2023. Things have improved slightly since then, haven't they?
I believe so. And one of the unknown facts was, even at the height of US-China tensions over Taiwan during the Pelosi visit, actually the amount of participants going to Shanghai Disney was still near an all-time high. So that suggested there's an element of geopolitics, and there's also an element of people-to-people relations between US and China. And I think that seems to be the non-controversial side that US and China would at least like to play to.
Professor Han Lin there. Well, all this comes as the Chinese economy and Chinese companies are struggling slightly. The economy grew by 5% in the first half of the year, and most Western countries would kill for that kind of growth. But it is low by China's standards over the past three decades. I'm joined by Fiona Sincotta, senior market analyst at City Index. And Fiona, we've had some more data out of China today, haven't we? Profits at China's industrial companies. What did that data show?
Yes, that's right. So Chinese industrial profits, basically, this is a key gauge for the financial health of factories, mines and utilities across China, and actually rose at the fastest pace in 5 months at 4.1%. But that rise was very much underpinned by a recovery in overseas orders, and domestic demand actually remained quite weak among sort of signs of sluggish consumption. So there are some warning signals being flashed in that data.
And also some gloomy news from one of China's, what has become one of China's flagship companies, Temu. This is a company which was only founded 2 years ago, and it's really changed the world of online shopping, heavily discounted consumer goods. It's owned by a company called PDD Holdings. They put out their earnings yesterday, and it had quite an impact on the markets, didn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, PDD Holdings fell 30% yesterday. It's falling a little bit further today. So we're seeing that sort of selling pressure continue. And that was basically after they warned yesterday of an inevitable profit decline. So this e-commerce company, which is behind Temu, as you said, gave really quite an unusually gloomy outlook. Its revenue missed estimates, and it's basically highlighting changing consumer demand and increased competition for the reasons of this. But what I think really surprising about this is a company that had actually been benefiting and been a main beneficiary of that sort of Chinese consumer downgrade, and yet they're still struggling. So I think, again, you know, more warning signals are being flashed here.
And we also had results overnight from the mining company, big mining company BHP, out of their headquarters in Australia. Their results weren't too bad. Revenue for the year to June, to the end of June, up 3%, and underlying net profit up 2%. But also a warning about China.
Yeah, there's definitely a theme here, isn't there? You're right. You know, BHP beat profits. We saw an underlying rise in profits as revenue from iron ore and copper increased. And that was despite that deteriorating outlook in China. But they did highlight sort of China's uneven recovery as a source of potential volatility in demand to continue. So if we just think, you know, the Chinese economy is showing signs of struggling. We've also got that languishing property market, which dampens demand for metals, because obviously they use the metals for support for construction. And so, you know, there are concerns about the demand for iron ore, which is used in the steel making for these constructions. So as that property market really struggles, that's affecting demand now for iron ore. And there are concerns about the outlook for that.
And yet China remains a massive market that Western businesses simply can't ignore. And we had one example of that, didn't we, Fiona? Boeing has been talking about China as well. Just briefly, tell us what they said.
Yeah, so Boeing basically predicts that China's aircraft demand will more than double by 2043. So in around 20 years, and they're expecting around 8,830. So just short of 9,000 new aircraft will be required over the next 20 years. So that does suggest that they are really quite upbeat about the demand outlook for travel in China over the coming decades.
Fiona, thanks very much for joining us. Now, it wasn't too long ago that China was the most populous country on earth, but it's recently been surpassed by India, which is fast heading towards a population of 1.5 billion. And that population is aging rapidly. It's estimated that the number of people over the age of 60 in India will double by the year 2050. An aging population does bring challenges, but also opportunities. Some companies in India are hoping to cash in on the booming silver economy, as the BBC's Arunaday Mukherjee reports.
In their 60s and on the road, this group of over a dozen old couples have travelled more than 1,000 kilometres away from their home in Maharashtra in western India, with one aim: checking things off their bucket lists. Travelling on a specially curated tour for senior citizens, the couples are visiting the city of Jaipur. Moving at a comfortable pace, stopping for photographs, taking in the sights and sounds of the city. For many, like Prakash and Preeti Parshikar, this is the first time they've had the chance to go on a trip like this.
We spent our entire lives working, caring for our children, giving them the best. We didn't have time to travel.
We also didn't have the money to do it as well before. I felt we haven't seen most of India. So why not do it now?
It's this sentiment that travel companies like Veena World felt would be a lucrative market to tap into. The company's founder, Sunila Patil, says this is a market segment that is time-rich and cash-rich.
They don't have to wait for a vacation to travel at any point. Like when you think of the younger age group or the families, the first thing happens is when school starts is you take the children's calendar and then you mark out when is it that you can travel. A senior citizen's age group is such that you name it and they can travel.
6 nights and 7 days ke liye rehta.
It's what Startup Senior World has also been trying to do. Rahul Gupta started the company 10 years ago, focusing primarily on helping senior citizens travel. Its initial success has now made them foray into other verticals, like making and selling special mobile phones for seniors, devices that can be remote operated by their children from anywhere around the world. Rahul also shows me an app his team has developed, helping the elderly connect with each other, find common hobbies, and join communities. Rahul tells me why he's betting big on this segment.
It has now come to a stage where, you know, it's getting attractive. The size is big. There are micro markets emerging which are monetizable. And it creates a huge opportunity. It is a blue ocean. Virtually nobody is focused on the segment, especially in a country like India where there are far more youngsters. It's easier to target. So we think it makes for a compelling business opportunity, both from a social standpoint in terms of impact, as well as from a financial standpoint going forward.
But not everyone can afford the services of companies like Veena World or Senior World. In most Indian cities and towns, you'll also see the more disadvantaged elderly population. According to the UN, 40% of the elderly in India fall among the poorest of the poor, while one-fifth have no income at all. While the government has some policies that give subsidized healthcare and aid to the elderly, welfare services for them are still largely relegated to the private sector and hence not free. And many in this travelling group acknowledge that privilege. An
As this batch of seniors dances to Bollywood hits at the end of their tour, can India keep pace with the needs of its aging population?
Arunadeh Mukherjee there. And this subject, ageing populations and how to deal with them, is one we'll be looking at all week on the programme. Tomorrow we'll have a report from here in the UK. Later in the week we'll be in Singapore and Kenya.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the latest exchange of fighting between Hezbollah and Israel. Does it bring us closer to a regional war? And will ceasefire negotiations for the Gaza conflict, the root of it all, ever come to an agreement? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. To the Philippines now, because the company that's building a new airport near the capital, Manila, has had to postpone the expected completion date by a year due to a lack of sand, which at first glance sounds a little bit odd in a country that's made up of over 7,000 islands and is home to thousands of beaches. Here's Elijah Feliz Rosales, a reporter at local newspaper, The Philippine Star.
First and foremost, the new Manila International Airport is being built by the Philippine food and infrastructure giants and Miguel Corporation. That airport, once completed, will become the largest gateway in the Philippines, with the first phase of the project able to facilitate as many as 35 million passengers a year. That is how important it is to Philippine air traffic.
So a big deal, but it's been delayed by a year. Can you tell me why?
San Miguel Chairman and CEO Ramon Ang says the conglomerate is stuck in the land development stage of the airport because of the lack of fill sand. Ang says San Miguel was affected by the presidential order to suspend reclamation activities in Manila Bay.
Okay, so the government has said that you can't dig sand from Manila Bay, and that's caused the problems for the company.
Yes, that is how it went.
Are there any alternatives, or does the company just have to wait until it can get some more sand from somewhere else?
Yes. Based on our interview with Mr. Ang, he's coordinating with the government on trying to address this lack of sand supply for the new Manila International Airport. If things go as planned and they get the sand within the year, they are poised to finish the airport by a year late to in 2028.
When you say if they can get the sand, so that presumably would involve importing sand from somewhere else.
Probably. That is a probable option.
Now, the delays to the airport are due to reasons specific to the Philippines. It's partly a consequence of the government's decision to halt a project to reclaim land from Manila Bay. But this is a good reminder of the importance of sand and that it's not an infinite resource. Shortages are becoming an issue for the construction industry worldwide, and they're having an impact on the environment as well as business. I've been speaking to Pascal Pedusi at the UN Environment Programme in Geneva.
Everything around us is made of sand. If you look at roads, asphalt, the building I've made of concrete. Concrete is sand, gravels, and cement. If you look at the windows, it's made of sand. So we are using a tremendous amount of sand. To give you an idea, every year we are using the amount of sand which is equal to 50 billion metric tons. To give you an image, it's enough sand to make a stack of sand of 27 meter high, 27 meter wide, all around equator every year. That's the amount of sand we're using as humans. It's the biggest solid material that humans are using.
But I guess lots of people listening to this will think, well, there's loads of sand in the world. The Sahara Desert, the Middle East, there's sand everywhere. Surely there's enough to go around.
First of all, we need sand close to where we are building our infrastructures and deserts. There's no one living there, so it will take a lot of money to transport and lots of CO2 being spent and emitted to transport sand from remote area. But the main thing is why we can't use desert sand is because it's produced by wind erosion and it creates a very fine round grain that do not bind together. So it's not fit for purpose. You can't use sand for land reclamation if it's coming from desert. What we need is edgy sand, and this edgy sand is produced by either glacier erosion, wave erosion, or river erosion.
So where do you find find the right kind of sand for construction?
In rivers, in quarries. That's actually the best way to get it, is from quarries. You make a hole, it has an impact on landscape, but sand in quarries or by crunching rocks, it doesn't interact with the ecosystem. So it's what we call static origin of sand. When you go to dynamic settings like rivers, beaches, or marine environments, then you have a large impact on the ecosystems, because in those locations, the sand plays and interacts with the environment. So when you take it from rivers, then it changed the water flows, it changed the turbidity of water, it can lead to riverbanks erosion. When you take it from the beaches, you have lots of animals that live there, crabs, birds, but also underwater, the fishes. And you're removing sand from the beaches, you are abusively removing the first line of defense against climate change, like silver rise, and the coastal area is more subject to erosion.
Are there any alternatives to sand?
There are many. The first thing is to reduce the amount of sand we're using. At the moment, we think it's so common, we are wasting it. The second thing is to recycle. You can also retrieve it from waste. When you are burning, incinerating waste, you can retrieve the bottom ashes, clean it from heavy metals that you can retrieve, and then use the bottom ashes as a substitute of sand. You can also use other types of material, like in UK we have lots of building with made of bricks. Then you can use wood, you can use adobe, as well as straw. Surprisingly enough, straw is a fantastic material for building. You make an architecture made of wood, and then the walls are made of straw. It's very good for insulation, very low carbon footprint, and very comfortable house. Even multi-story floors can be done with a building made of straw.
Pascal Peduzzi there talking to me from Geneva. And staying in Switzerland, you think of the country, you might think about its famous cheese, cuckoo clocks, or if you're like me, chocolate. Switzerland produces more than 200,000 tons of chocolate each year, with sales worth almost $2 billion. But the industry faces sustainability issues, and it's susceptible to the volatile price of cocoa. So researchers in Switzerland are looking at new ways to make chocolate. The BBC's Imogen Folks has been finding out more.
In a small laboratory in Zurich's prestigious Institute of Federal Technology, known here as the ETH, chocolate scientist Kim Mishra and cocoa specialist Anjan Schreiber are admiring a cocoa fruit. Green and yellow, oval-shaped and the size of a pumpkin, in Anjan's view, underestimated if only its beans are used.
As we see now with the cocoa crisis in West Africa, where the cocoa prices have soared by 500% over the last 12 months, we see that the system is just inevitably broke. I think one solution to it is to use the entire fruit. Many aspects of the cocoa fruit that are delicious, and so far they're left behind to decay on the fields.
Kim Mishra is working with Anjan to produce a new, more sustainable chocolate.
Hi, nice to meet
you.
I've come to Choco Suisse, the Association of Swiss Chocolate Makers, to talk to its director, Roger Verley.
I think there are very interesting proposals, like the one you mentioned from ETH. I mean, to use the whole cocoa fruit, and then you even don't need any sugar anymore. If you use the whole cacao fruit, you can, I think you can get better prices, because you don't waste part of the fruit. So it's economically interesting for the farmers. It's interesting from an ecological point of view. That's why I think it's really a good idea.
Make chocolate without sugar? Surely not possible. In fact, back in their laboratory, Kim and Anjan are doing just that, using first the juice of the cocoa fruit.
Do you want to try some of this? Maybe the easiest is to start with the juice.
So this is the juice of the cocoa fruit.
Exactly.
Actually, that's really nice. I mean, like pineapple, maybe not quite as acidic.
The juice has 14% sugar.
The juice is then concentrated down to a thick syrup.
Yeah, I think you could compare it to maple syrup.
Yeah. This you could put on your toast.
Yeah.
This is very sweet.
Yeah.
And making sure nothing goes unused, the husk or endocarp is used as a thickening agent.
So the endocarp is not sweet at all, and that's why it's typically left on the field, basically fertilizer or compost, which is sad. And that is why we thought, hey, maybe we can turn this into a powder, and use this powder, which is rich in pectins.
Without the endocarp, the chocolate would not solidify. The process is, says Anion, a win-win for cocoa farmers and chocolate producers.
You use more of what is already there, right? So instead of like fighting over who gets how much of the cake, you make the cake larger and make everybody benefit. The farmers get significantly extra income through utilizing cocoa pulp, but also that the important industrial processing is happening in a country of origin, creating jobs, creating value that can be distributed in the country of origin.
It all sounds amazing. So why haven't we always made chocolate like this? Although some big chocolate producers are already using the cocoa fruit as well as the beans, none so far have left out sugar completely. As Kim explains, there are economic reasons for that.
I expect it to be a bit more expensive than conventional chocolate. The cheapest ingredient in food will always be sugar, as long as we subsidize it. I think there is where we stand. We have to now find daring chocolate producers who want to test the market.
Imogen Folks reporting there from Switzerland. And we end the programme today with the big news of the day, where we are here near Manchester in the north of the UK. Our producer, Matt Lyons, has been very excited about this all day and joins me in the studio. Matt, what's the news?
Oh, I'm just a little bit excited. It's because one of Manchester's most famous bands, one of my favourite bands, Oasis, are finally back together and they're going on tour. To give you a bit of an idea of how much I'm a fan of theirs, I've got all their albums on vinyl. I've even got a signed Noel Gallagher birthday message on my wall in my flat. So I'm a big fan. It's been 15 years since they split. The Gallaghers have finally put aside their differences, for now at least, and announced a series of huge gigs across the UK and Ireland for next summer, with dates around the world to follow soon. You know, obviously they were huge cultural icons. People thought they might not ever get back together. But because we're an economics programme, they might make an awful lot of money from this tour as well.
Yeah, I guess this could, in theory, be one of the highest grossing tours of all time.
I imagine that's what they're hoping for. The artist to beat, as you might think, predictably, is Taylor Swift. We've spoken about her quite a lot on this programme. Her Eras tour, which is still ongoing and finishes later this year, has already grossed over $1 billion. In second place, Coldplay, whose Music of the Spheres World Tour, which is also still going, has taken in more than $945 million so far. And Elton John's Farewell Yellow Brick Road Tour, his final tour, which ended last year, included his headline set at Glastonbury Festival here in the UK. That's in third place on the list, earning nearly $940 million when it finished last year. So let's see what the take-up is going to be for their concerts next July and August. I mean, I imagine it's going to be a nightmare to get tickets that go on sale on Saturday in the UK, but I'm going to try my best to get one.
And I think Fiona Sincotra is still with us. Oasis fans, Fiona, are you going to be looking for tickets?
Oh, definitely. I will be there trying to get hold of them as well. I mean, you know, it's been a long time since they've last played together. So I was a big fan back then and I'm still a big fan now.
Great news for Oasis fans, and that brings us to the end of this edition of World Business Report. Thanks for listening.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the latest exchange of fighting between Hezbollah and Israel. Does it bring us closer to a regional war? And will ceasefire negotiations for the Gaza conflict, the root of it all, ever come to an agreement? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.